Hello and welcome to Dialect from the Bristol Radio Co-op. Hello to everyone in Bristol and listeners on Preston FM, that's 103.2 up there in Preston. Hello to people in Birmingham on Unity FM 93.5 and also Radio Verulam in St Albans. Coming up on the show, our guest this week is Steve Dale, and he's going to talk about the vital role of volunteers, not only in Bristol but in British society generally. And Trevor Carter is also here to read us one of his poems. Jeff Sparks is back in the studio for his What's On Guide and a Song of the Week. I'm John Peters Coleman, and our first guest this week is Steve Dale. Hello.
Hello, John.
You are from Volunteering Bristol. Tell me a little bit about that. Whereabouts in Bristol is it?
Okay, so Volunteering Bristol is right at the centre of Bristol on Queen Square. And our job, put simply, is to help people to get involved in their communities. So we're a kind of matchmaking service between people who would like to volunteer their time for a good cause and organisations that need a bit of help. So we get around 10,000 inquiries every year from people who want to volunteer. And there's around 600 volunteering opportunities for them to choose from in about 400 different sort of voluntary and community organisations, big and small, across Bristol.
So is it like a standalone organisation, or are you sort of part of a network across other cities?
We're part of a network. There are a few hundred volunteer centres around the country, and we've all got a kind of common identity, but we're all separate organisations.
Okay, right. And do you have a sort of a big AGM where you can all network and press the flesh and talk shop?
There are various ways that we get together. We come together sort of quite kind of regionally in little clusters and try and kind of work together as much as we can.
Well, we've had plenty of volunteers from your organisation, or through your organisation, I should say, that's come down here. And I've got a couple here tonight that I'm looking at. So what sort of a range of people do you wind up coming through your doors?
Our basic message is that kind of however much time you've got, whoever you are, whatever you want to do, whatever turns you on, really, there's something out there for everyone. So if you were to look at our website right now, you'd find that we're getting to that time of year. We're looking for volunteer Santa and elves. We're looking for volunteers to help in a local homeless shelter. And we're even looking for pianists to play live music in the dining saloon of the SS Great Britain, which, for those people who aren't Bristol-based, is a big steamship built by Brunel.
Oh, that's fantastic. Have you found the recession has impacted upon volunteering Bristol? I mean, my assumption would be that a lot of redundancies might give people more time on their hands.
I mean, in general, up and down the country, volunteer centres reported something like a 30% increase in inquiries about volunteering. And certainly my own experience, we had a lot more people coming to the volunteer centres who had been affected by the recession. And perhaps they'd been working in the same job for maybe 20 years, found themselves redundant, and are looking for something which either kind of fills their time or something which perhaps gets them thinking about a career change. But the statistics are quite horrifying, actually, when you look at the impact that being unemployed can have on someone in a relatively small amount of time. So you may have had someone who's been working at a really high level for a number of years, but take them out of work for a few weeks, a few months, and their self-esteem starts to drop.
So
their
people
confidence.
For whom work winds up becoming a crutch, you take it away and then they don't really have a support mechanism left.
Absolutely. Work is so much part of our identity that take it away and you start to question who you are and what you're doing.
So how are people who sort of ring in and turn up? I mean, how many actually go on to do things, and sort of how many time wasters do you want them to deal with?
It's always really hard for us to know what happens, and that's why it's great to be here and for you to say to me that actually so many of the people running this operation are actually volunteers. I mean, that's brilliant, and that's not an experience we get every day. We've done a bit of tracking, and our best figure that we can come up with is that about half of the people that use our service end up volunteering.
That's not bad.
Now, the national picture is about 1 in 4 people. Locally, we've managed to say that it's about 50%, which is, if it's true, it's great.
Okay, fair enough. Is there anything particularly unique about volunteering in Bristol, if through your experience of sort of chatting to other people in volunteering institutions? I mean, you've already highlighted there might be one sort of unique facet to us, and as far as more people actually wind up volunteering, is there anything else you find particularly interesting about volunteering in Bristol?
It's hard to say. I mean, Bristol's got a reputation as a kind of big activist city, lots of people interested in particularly kind of environment and sort of conservation volunteering. So I guess that's always quite big on our agenda. But I think that nationally there will be, each volunteer centre is its own organisation that has its own identity, and people deal with really different types of inquiries.
Yeah.
I mean, generally speaking, volunteer centres tend to be really good at working with people who maybe face a few barriers to their volunteering. So there are lots of people who will, when they want to volunteer, they'll just Google volunteering and they'll sort it all out. But there are lots of other people who would really benefit from volunteering, but don't quite know how, need a bit of extra support. And that's what volunteer centres are really, really good at.
How do you deal with sort of people with learning disabilities and people who may not be able to take up a full-time job? Is there sort of volunteering positions for people like that?
Right now in Bristol, we're very lucky to have a specific project dedicated to working with people who've got, you know, particular barriers to volunteering. So it might be they've got a disability, it might be that they're a refugee or asylum seeker and, you know, English isn't their first language, it might be that they've got mental health issues, and, you know, all of which kind of prevent people from taking those first steps. But there's lots of evidence to say that, you know, once you can get someone into volunteering and provide that extra service, that it's great for their mental health, it's great for their physical health, and, you know, they benefit from that sort of, from being the helpers rather than the helped, really.
Okay. How have you found budget decisions and your budget generally, since obviously the cuts have come in? We've had a depression for the last couple of years or more. So how have you found, has that impacted on the service that you provide?
Not yet, is the answer.
Do you get a lot of grants? Is that how you're funded?
Yeah, largely volunteer centres receive grants, and the biggest grant funders for volunteer centres are kind of local authorities. Now, we all know that, you know, local councils are facing big cuts to their budgets, and we largely in the voluntary sector, we haven't felt the full effects of the recession yet, because we're often on three-year contracts with our funders.
Okay,
and so, you know, it takes a bit of time to filter down to the voluntary sector, but it's coming and we're starting to get a picture of what it's going to look like.
Is it a pretty dark image?
I think, being optimistic about it, what it's going to do is ensure that we think in new ways about how we can fund our service. We're going to have to work together, we're going to have to be quite innovative, and we are going to have to draw on all our resources. I mean, there's two things happening at the moment, and one is the recession that we have to deal with. There's much bigger demand on the kind of organisations that we work with, because they're the people who are helping the most vulnerable people in society. Mm. So there's a huge demand on their services at the same time as there's a huge cut in the amount of money available to them.
Tell me a little bit about the big society. You did mention it in passing in conversation before we started the interview. And a lot of people have viewed that as a bit of just, you know, an excuse for some cuts. But are you part of the big society? Are you helping? Are you doing your part?
Yeah, well, I would say that we've been purveyors of big society for 40 years, that's very much what Volunteering Bristol is about. So we kind of embrace the ideal of the big society, which is about people getting out there and doing what you guys are doing, which is, you know, taking an active part in your community. It's a shame that the big society ideas come at the same time as cuts, because it's always going to look as if, you know, it's just a way to get things done cheaply. Yeah. Now, volunteering is a way to kind of make the money go a lot further at the same time as being able to, for people to get kind of real skills and real experiences. It's a win-win, but it's not free.
Cameron might be flogging an old horse at an inappropriate time, possibly.
Possibly. I couldn't begin to disentangle that metaphor.
I mean, on a similar theme, I mean, are there any rules, like on broadcasting, political bias, etc.? I mean, volunteerism might sort of become a conduit for people with a sort of a political bent to sort of attract people. Is there sort of any rule of organisations as we're looking for volunteers, you know, are political, people with a political angle or...
In general, volunteer centres tend to deal with non-political groups, and they don't tend to deal so much with advertising faith-based organisations, but in reality we do a little bit. We just make sure that people understand that it's a faith-based organisation, and
so
that they may or may not be
charity,
cool with that.
It's not a big deal, you know.
Yeah.
Right. Well, tell me a little bit about how people can get in touch. How can people get involved?
Okay, so in general, if you're interested in volunteering, there are volunteer centres all over the country. And by going to the Volunteering England website, that's a great way to find your nearest volunteer centre.
Okay.
In Bristol, you can look at our website, which is www.bristolvolunteers.org.uk.
Okay. Well, Stephen Dale, thank you very much for coming in.
Thank you.
Our first music track this week is from a band in Beira, Mozambique. Our intrepid reporter, Anthea Page, has just returned from there, and she met the guitarist from the band. It's called Mbilo, that's the name of the track, and it's by Nyaka. This band has played in major cities all over Europe, but not yet in Britain, so maybe we could change that.
Na kudumbisa, ita
That was Mbilo by Nyaka. The name of the track is M-B-I-L-O, Mbilo, and the band is spelled N-Y-A-C-H-A, in case you wanted to look them up on the internet. Our next feature is an interview with Leslie Rowe, the US ambassador to Mozambique, talking about the US program there.
So I'm here at the Pemba Beach Hotel in Pemba, northern Mozambique, and I'm here with the US ambassador to Mozambique, Leslie Rowe. Hello.
Hello. It's very nice to meet you.
Can you tell us what your role is here in the north, what you've come up to the north to do?
Well, one reason that I've come up is, and this is my first trip to Pemba, I've been here about 8 months, and so I've come to take a look at how some of our assistance programs are going. And our largest area of assistance is HIV and AIDS. So I had the opportunity to go to one of the local clinics and see how our assistance from the Centers for Disease Control is being implemented in the maternity ward and also various other parts of the hospital. And I had a chance to also talk with activists, a number of women, who most of whom are HIV positive, along with their children. They're also receiving some assistance, and they act in the community. They go out and try and help people who are HIV positive, make sure they're getting their medication, and they reach out to the communities and give education, for instance, to young people so that they can avoid getting HIV. We also went to a basketball camp. We have two professional basketball players from the United States who are here, Kim and Cameron, quite tall, and they're actually playing for a professional Mozambican team for this year, and they volunteered to come out and do basketball camps, and through those camps with young people from the secondary school here in Pemba, they are giving information again on HIV and AIDS. So that was really very special to see them with about 30 children and playing basketball, teaching them that, but also telling them how to stay safe and avoid becoming HIV positive. That's one area. We have another major area, which we came up for yesterday. We've given the government of Mozambique, the Navy, 12... What are they called in English now? They're inflatable boats, and it's to help them patrol the coast. As you might know, Mozambique has a problem with various illegal activities along the coast. It's an extremely large, long coast, and they have very little capacity to patrol it. So there's illegal fishing, illegal drugs coming in, some illegal migration of people from the north, from countries like Somalia and other areas, the Congo, et cetera. Then you have, in going in the other direction, trees being cut down illegally, being exported, precious stones as well. And so we donated these 12 boats along with some other equipment and training and radar, a radar system, to assist the Mozambicans in patrolling their coast.
So what other activities do you do up here?
We do a number of, as I mentioned, HIV/AIDS activities, but also trying to give information on nutrition and food programs. Because the problem with the HIV/AIDS drugs is that they're quite powerful. Mozambique is quite poor. Often people don't get enough food, and so we have some grants in which people are going out into the communities teaching women about nutritious food. I went to one village, actually in another province, and the women in the village gave me samples of four different kinds of cereal, very, very nutritious, but also very tasty cereal that they give to their children, actually much tastier than the cream of wheat and the oatmeal that I had when I was growing up. And it's an easy way for the children and other people in the community to have nutrition, which also helps in terms of taking very powerful HIV/AIDS drugs.
There seems to be very little cultivation going on here, farms, proper farms. Is there any way that you could help that situation?
We are helping in agriculture as well, and working with emerging farmers, particularly in some of the other provinces, but our USAID is doing some programs in helping agricultural production. there are a number of other things that we're doing up here, but those are the major areas. Our USAID has also just developed, along with a partner, an investment booklet to encourage people to come in and invest in Pemba, particularly in the area of tourism. It's a beautiful, as you know, it's quite beautiful up here. The bay is one of the most spectacular in the world, and lots of tourism, snorkeling, deep sea fishing, historical sites to go to, and as well as game parks. So we're trying to support Pemba and the government of Pemba in developing tourism here.
So do you think by developing the game parks, it'll stop the unnecessary killing of protected animals?
Yes, actually, we've been trying to support environmental education as well, and we're doing that in other parts of Mozambique. And working with the local communities, we set up one environmental center, actually near Gorongosa National Park. And the goal of that environmental center is to educate the people in the area who surround the park about the benefits of conserving the animals and how their tourism can grow if they aren't poaching animals, etc. So that's another area that we're trying to work in.
So it's long-term education rather than quick profit for the moment?
I would say that, yes, and particularly working in schools with the children. And some of them are, I understand, are going home and telling their parents about the fact that you need to keep the animals safe. And those programs are quite successful because they take children into the park. And often the parks are frequented by tourists who come in from outside the country. And sometimes the local people can't afford to go into a game park. And so that program is also taking children into the park, introducing them to the animals, taking them around in safari vehicles, etc., and teaching them about the resource that they have and wonderful animals that are in Mozambique.
Aimed at involving everybody about the dangers of the animals becoming extinct, basically.
Absolutely, and also trying to engender a sense of pride. Some wonderful resources here in Mozambique, but I think a number of Mozambicans don't know about them all. It's quite poor here. They don't have the opportunities to become acquainted, as I mentioned, in things like national parks. And so it's a way of showing them the resources that they already have that can be developed, which will help their own social and economic development.
So is the U.S. involved in any other countries in the southern part of Africa, or is it mainly Mozambique?
No, we're actually involved in all of the countries of southern Africa, particularly in our HIV and AIDS program throughout Swaziland, Lesotho, Botswana, South Africa. All of those countries we're involved in as well. It's actually our largest assistance program in Africa, begun under our former president and continued by President Obama. And because it's been quite successful, a lot of lives have been saved. There are now about 2.5 million people who are on antiretroviral therapy through this program. And we've continued to fund it as our major contribution to Africa.
That was our Anthea Page there talking to Leslie Rowe, the US ambassador to Mozambique. You heard the ambassador mention Gorongosa National Park, and in next week's programme, you can hear an interview with Greg Carr, who developed voicemail, no less, and has used his vast fortune to restock the national park with animals after it was decimated during the 16-year civil war. Last weekend, you may have noticed the political tension rise as the Irish government was forced to take a multi-billion pound bailout by the IMF. This raises some questions about whether the same will happen to Britain in the months to come. Will George Osborne be forced to borrow more and more as the recession bites? Well, I'm joined by Dialect's own Tony Gosling to help pick apart this knotty problem. Hello.
Hi, John.
Okay, so explain to us, what has the IMF done that is unique in the last week?
Well, actually, what's happened in Ireland is something the IMF have been doing for probably 30, 40 years, ever since they were formed as part of the Bretton Woods Conference after the Second World War. It's just that this time they're doing it here at home. They've been doing this in third world countries, in the South, in South America, Africa and other poorer countries in the developing world for a long, long time. And I think it's fair to say that what they're doing, restructuring these countries, is a sort of modern form of colonialism, but it's a kind of financial colonialism. So what they do is they come along to a country and say, well, if you want some more money, basically, you you have to privatise large parts of your country and sell them on the open market. And of course, financiers around the world then invest in them and buy them. But up until recently, this has been the sort of thing that happens in the developing world, not here closer to home, like in Britain and Ireland.
Presumably, as long as the industries are regulated, okay, it shouldn't really be a problem, should it?
How do you mean, regulated?
Industries that are privatised, if they are regulated to run well in accordance with the rules of competition.
Well, that would be nice. That would be nice. But I think our experience, for example, with our privatised industries is that they simply aren't regulated properly. Look at the buses, for example, in Bristol.
Okay, fair enough. Well, we've interviewed people recently. They're now going to operate a free bus service. Fantastic. But that is elsewhere on the internet. Has there anything similar ever happened in Britain on these shores?
Well, actually, something very similar did happen back in the 1970s with Harold Wilson, because the IMF were in talks with the Labour government at the time, and they threatened Britain. And actually, what Harold Wilson did is he called their bluff. He was the Labour Prime Minister, and he said, well, look, if you think this is such an important thing, I'm going to call a general election on this issue, at which point the IMF backed off.
I see, right. I mean, tell me a little bit, is this Celtic Tiger really a bit of a false thing? I mean, interest rates are such that the Irish are effectively being paid to borrow money. So
it's a bubble. It's a bubble, which means that lots of money is lent with the knowledge that that can't be then paid back. So it's an artificial bubble that's been created.
Okay. And what has happened to the credit rating?
It's going down all the time.
Okay, and, well, this may possibly be a likelihood for Britain, who knows. What are the political implications of calling an Irish election in the new year?
Well, the interesting thing here is that Gerry Adams from Sinn Féin has given up his fighting politically in the north, and he's decided he's going to fight in the south. So it would be very interesting to see. It could even be that Sinn Féin do extremely well if this election goes ahead early in the new year.
Okay.
And that actually that they will take a much, much harder line with the IMF and probably tell them where to go.
Okay,
also, they are aware that the banks are basically bankrupt, and therefore they what Sinn Féin might well do is simply say, well, if you're bankrupt, we're going to send in the receivers.
But once we've stripped away the bubble, what is the core problem and how do we solve that problem?
Well, that problem is explained by Bill Steele, and I think we'd better let him do that now. He's a filmmaker from the US.
Okay, here he is now.
In the book version, the Yellow Brick Road was not a good thing. It was a dangerous road that could only be traversed when Dorothy had on the magical silver slippers. And, of course, that was at any point she could escape from her travails by clicking the heels of her silver slippers together three times. And what that meant was that America, unbeknownst to most of the population, could escape the Depression merely by adding additional money to the system, just like you in your own personal life. You can escape your financial travails if someone stuck a bunch of extra money in your pocket. Of course, we can do that, and we can do it without debt, and that is the problem right now. Our system is entirely not only laden with debt, but based on debt, and we can never get out of debt because of that, and that's why all these austerity measures that are currently being enforced on Britain will absolutely never work, because the debt and the interest caused by the debt is way too big, and the austerity that you can actually cut out of a system is way too small, and so eventually this system will still collapse.
But haven't we been running debt for decades, if not hundreds of years?
Yes, absolutely. But the system has now reached something that economists are calling for the first time debt saturation, where the interest on the debt has just become so huge. For example, in the United States, I don't know the British situation, but in the United States, the interest paid on the debt is greater than the total discretionary spending of the United States Congress every year. In other words, all the stuff that we argue about, oh, we're spending too much money on bridges to nowhere, blah, 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 you may have heard. All of that is exceeded by the interest we pay mostly to bankers on our money, the interest on the national debt, a totally unnecessary expenditure. We don't have to do it that way. We don't have to have our money based on debt. And a nation, the thing that makes a sovereign nation sovereign is that it can create its own money without debt. It's a scam that bankers essentially have perpetrated on us that we don't need and is now killing the system, and it's killing it worldwide.
Well, that was Bill Steele there, a former US newspaper manager turned filmmaker. In 1995, he released a 3.5-hour long film called The Money Masters. And his latest film, released last year in 2009, is all about how money works and is called The Secret of Oz. When financial tensions mount, so does military tension. And we saw an exchange of fire between North and South Korea last week. Tony is still here with us. Tony, who started it?
Well, that's a very, very difficult, almost impossible for us to know, because both sides always blame the other for starting it. Now, we do know that the South Koreans were having a massive exercise on the border. What the North Koreans said is that if you do any live firing as part of this exercise, then we will fire back. And that's what it seems has started this. So it's kind of six of one and a half dozen of the other. But it is rather silly to be doing live firing exercise right on the border. Personally, I would think that the South Koreans should be, if they're going to want to do their exercises, do them somewhere else.
Fair enough. I mean, by coincidence, we mentioned the conflict of this nature between North and South Korea last week. Did we predict the future, Tony? What's going on?
Well, we did. Just briefly mention this game, which came out about a month ago, called DMZ, The Next Korean War. And bizarrely, the Decision Games from Bakersfield in California have issued this game, which allows you to fight the next Korean War. Just quoting from them, it says, technically speaking, the Korean War has remained active since the ceasefire agreement of 1953. The belligerents have never actually ratified a final peace accord. This game lasts about 2 hours and it enables you to sort of continue what we saw last week as a proper battle in the comfort of your living room.
So keep your eye on Decision Games, and the future conflicts of the world may become apparent to you before the event. Possibly, who knows? Certainly with leadership changes undergoing in North Korea, I'm sure we'll probably see further interesting actions by North Korea in the future as well, do you think?
I would imagine so, and there are several other tension spots as well, like India, Pakistan, Israel, Palestine. You just don't know what's going to happen in some of these places, and it would be nice if we could have proper peace agreements where, you know, having exercises on the border is not the clever thing to do.
Okay, thank you very much to Tony Gosling there. Our next feature is by Michaela Dennis. It's an interview with Emily Morton about a campaign run by Bristol City Council to make Bristol a safer city and combat violence against women.
And with me today, I've got Emily Morton from Safer Bristol. Emily is the Assistant Project Officer for the Domestic Violence Team, is that right?
That's right, yeah.
Yes, welcome.
Thank you.
So tell us a bit about what you do in your role.
My role is mainly about supporting professionals who are working in the field of domestic violence and abuse. So I do things like coordinate our training programme, work with our trainers to develop new courses in response to people's needs. I coordinate our multi-agency professionals forum, so I support the chair who's involved with that. I'm working on setting up a survivors forum, so a way for survivors of abuse to feed more into what's going on in Bristol, how things develop and change. And then I'm involved with our publicity and campaigning work.
Okay, tell me a little bit more about the survivors forum, because that sounds really interesting, that someone's experiences can then feed back into actually policy making and making things better in the future for the council policy.
Sure. We're only just getting started, so it's quite a sort of exciting kind of ground roots sort of phase that it's in at the moment. So we had a survivors conference back in March, which was amazingly well attended. We had sort of 50 or 60 women who came along to meet with the different agencies and tell them what they were doing well and what they could be doing better and how they could change to improve things. And we're hoping that really positive things are going to come out of that. And what message we got from that was that people didn't want this to be a one-off. They wanted to be able to carry on feeding into things and to carry on meeting up with each other and sort of being able to support each other and get support from other people who'd experienced what they had. So we're looking at ways to involve women in coming along to meetings, looking at training programs, looking at strategies and saying, okay, this is what happened to me and this is how I think that this could be changed, or this is what you haven't thought of that you should have thought of. And we're also hoping to have a sort of a social arm to it as well, so women can carry on meeting each other and supporting each other.
Great. I mean, are there lots of agencies that provide support in Bristol? Is it kind of a patchwork of lots of different people providing lots of different things, or is there kind of one person, like one agency you go to?
There's three main agencies providing support in Bristol, who are NextLink, Wish and Victim Support, who do various types of support for different groups of people. So, for example, NextLink only work with women and Wish work down in the south of Bristol. There's also the Freedom Programme, which is a survivor group work programme for any woman who's experienced domestic abuse or has experienced it in the past to come along and learn a bit more about abusers and society and kind of patterns of abuse to help them understand what happened to them. And then there's also a lot of fantastic people in various agencies. So there's, you know, specially trained solicitors working for some of the legal firms in Bristol. There's the Police Public Protection Unit, who are doing fantastic work around training and skilling up police officers and looking at things like the positive arrest policy, which says that if you report abuse to the police, they should arrest the abuser and take him out of the home for a 24-hour period. Sort of people in the housing department or in children's services who are just, you know, trying to champion domestic violence support within their agency.
So every aspect is covered, I suppose.
That's the theory anyway.
Yeah.
The trouble is it so often depends on kind of one passionate person within that department promoting it and sort of stamping their feet and yelling about the need for support. And, you know, if they move on, there can be a bit of a gap. So one of the things that my boss is looking at is sort of how can we get domestic violence support written into people's job descriptions and into agency strategies and get it to be more of a mainstream thing and less of a thing that's dependent on an individual person.
Sure. What is there a problem in Bristol? Because lots of people don't want to talk about domestic violence. It's not something that's, you know, mentioned kind of day to day. And as you say, you know, you need that, those passionate people who on the policy side to kind of keep pushing stuff forward, even kind of for people who have to provide stuff. So, I mean, is there a problem in Bristol?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, statistics show us that one in four women will experience domestic violence or abuse during their lifetimes. We've got no reason to think that the numbers in Bristol are any lower, so you're looking at 25% of Bristol's female population, which is a lot of people. There was a recent survey done called the Quality of Life Survey, which asks about people's opinions on various things. So it doesn't specifically ask about have you experienced abuse, but it does ask things like, do you believe that domestic violence and abuse is a private matter? And the statistics that we're seeing coming out of that are quite scarily high. So you've got a lot of people thinking that actually, even if they know someone's being abused, that they shouldn't interfere. And, you know, what we'd say is quite often domestic violence is actually a crime. And for a lot of people, what they say afterwards is, what I really, really wanted was somebody to ask me, you know, are you being abused? They wanted to tell somebody, but they weren't ready to just come out and say it. So it's worrying to know that there's a lot of people who wouldn't consider doing that.
Sure, it must be hard as well because you know about all the people who have come forward, who have, or at least got to a point, you know, where they're asking for help. There must be an awful lot of people who, as you say, don't even realise that what's happening to them is a crime. I mean, how are you trying to kind of reach those people?
We do a lot of, as part of the Domestic Abuse Forum, one of our aims is to do campaigning and awareness raising work. So we produce leaflets, we produce posters, we maintain websites, and then we run three campaigns every year, one in February around Valentine's Day, one in the summer, which usually focuses on abuse within young people's relationships, and then one in November, which centres around the UN Day for the Elimination of Violence Against Women on the 25th of November. And they all aim at kind of leaping around and shouting about domestic violence and trying to raise people's awareness and inform them about what the problem is, what abuse actually is, what they can do to help somebody if they think someone they know is being abused, and how they can access help themselves if they need it.
So I presume there's something going on this November. What event have you got on?
This year's End Violence Against Women Week is going to be amazing. I'm really looking forward to it. We work with a lot of agencies who are doing various things. And then there's sort of a plethora of events that happen during the week. So it's launching on the 22nd of November on Monday at 10 a.m. at the Council House. We've got speakers coming along, including the CEO of CADA, which is a big national domestic violence agency that's based in Bristol, who we're really excited to have along. There's going to be stalls and information, and we're also going to be showing a short film that we've just made in conjunction with the police and NextLink, which is called Our Story, which is five survivors telling their story of what happened to them and how they escaped, which is just incredibly, incredibly moving to watch. So that will be our launch event. Then during the week, we're having a pub quiz with prizes, amazing prizes. We're having a candlelit walk to remember people who have experienced domestic violence, and lighting two candles to represent the two women who are killed every week by a partner or an ex-partner. We've got on Wednesday, we've got a group of men from various agencies, including the Probation Service and Relate, going down to Temple Meads to hand out white ribbons, which is sort of the men's arm of the campaign. What else have we got going on? Loads of things. Students from the City of Bristol College have got involved this year, which is really exciting for us. So they're going around their sites getting people to do painted hand pledges to pledge that they won't raise a hand in violence. And they'll also be showing a short film that they've made, sort of talking to professionals and people who've experienced abuse about what it means to them, how people can get support. And then we're also launching two new resources, which will hopefully again help to raise awareness. So one is a leaflet, which is about, it's aimed at friends and family about how you can talk to somebody who's experiencing violence and abuse. And then the second one is a poster, which is a series of men's faces and has the slogan that if I thought someone I knew was experiencing abuse, I'd stand up, would you? Which is about encouraging, again, people to stand up and say, this isn't okay, and to go to their friends and say, how can I help you? So we're hoping that they'll sort of go up around the city and be a really useful resource for people.
Fantastic. Just for I ask my last question, can you give a website so people can kind of find out about the events and go and kind of help and get involved?
Yeah, absolutely. If you go to www.bdaf.org.uk and look for the campaigns tab down the side and then End Violence Against Women Week, I can't remember the exact address, but that will take you there. You can download a flyer which includes all of the events that are going on, and it's all listed on the website as well.
Fantastic. So my final question, I had two in my head, but the first one is, how do you go about kind of not demonising men in what you do and kind of looking at things from a, blame perspective in a way, but how do you just go about that without kind of getting people's backs up? Because I can imagine there's kind of, I don't know, antipathy there.
Yeah, absolutely. I think the really important message to put across is that domestic violence and abuse is a gendered crime. So overwhelmingly, more women are victims of it than men, and they are overwhelmingly victims at the hands of men. That doesn't mean all women are victims, and it doesn't mean all men are abusers. It doesn't even mean all abusers are men. Just that this is a pattern that we see. And it's really important for men to actually kind of take their own role in the campaign to say, you know what, I'm not an abuser, and my stand here is, you know, I'm a supportive friend, I'm a brother, I'm a father, I'm a husband. And that can be really valuable, and especially for young men to see other men standing up there and saying, actually, you know what, this is not okay. So, but yeah, it's difficult because it's hard to hear a message that sounds like, you know, you're a man, you're an abuser.
Sure.
Which is not the message that we would ever try and put across. So that men who abuse are wrong in the same way that women who abuse are wrong. But men who don't abuse, we have no problem with you.
Fantastic.
Carry on.
That's a fantastically positive way of ending this interview. Thank you very much for joining me, Emily.
Thank you.
Thank you very much to Michaela Dennis there, and also to Emily Morton for agreeing to be interviewed. Well, Trevor Carter is here in the studio. He's the Bard of Wimble Hill. Hello.
Yes, still the Bard of Wimble Hill. This first one is slightly dated. It's about the BBC. You remember that thing about Bob Geldof being slandered by this news programme, and they had to issue an apology on all channels?
Right, okay, yeah.
And there's also an issue with a woman on one Nature programme who is now currently bringing a case for unfair dismissal because she's no longer looks enough like eye candy, so they want to get make way for a newer model, you know. So it's not very nice, really. So
no.
I'm having a little bit of a go at the BBC.
Do so.
Appalling standards. The BBC is in the news for putting out some slanderous views about Sir Bob and his fine deeds. Such tittle-tattle spreads like weeds, and many thought it true, you see, as it came from the BBC. Yes, standards fall in modern times when news reporters are inclined not to question, is it true? But just to think, oh, this'll do, let's go ahead and put it out. They do not entertain their doubt. A pity about the BBC. Many people I talk to agree that it has gone the modern way and let its standards go astray. Its bosses, in their ivory towers, misuse our cash, abuse their powers. It is no longer in top gear. It's lost its way. That much is clear. Producing dross now seems its goal. Jeremy Clarkson, one sick soul. While women are sacked for being old, can this be true? It is, I'm told. So I suggest to make things better, they could take notice of this letter. Give jobs to poets such as me. I am not proud. I work for free. I'm sitting waiting for the call. I've nothing else to do at all.
Thank you very much. Do you have anything else with which to entertain?
Oh, yes, I've just written this, actually, whilst I've been waiting.
Oh, brilliant.
Yeah, I heard on the news about the Ofsted inspectors. I used to work at Bath College, and I did write a diatribe whilst I was there about Ofsted inspectors. which was on the in staff room, remained on staff room wall for quite a long time. Yeah, so basically they've been having a go at teachers, saying that too many of the lessons are merely satisfactory. Of course, when I went to school, you know, the meaning of satisfactory is that things are satisfactory, i.e. good enough, yeah. i.e. fine, you know.
Yeah.
So, yeah, just thinking about that, really. The semantics of Ofsted inspectors, I suggest, should be due for review. I think they should show more respect, as I think satisfactory should do. Satisfactory should be satisfactory. It should mean it's quite good enough. The school's not a sausage factory. Sometimes it gets pretty tough. We need to inspect the inspectors and get them to say what they mean. I think they should read dictionaries to ensure that their language is clean.
Trevor Carter, thank you very much.
Thank you, John.
Well, Jeff Sparks is here, ready with the Song of the Week and What's On. Hello.
Hello, John. This is your What's On guide from Dialect Radio. Starting with Thursday, 2nd of December, The Godfathers will be performing at the Thunderbolt in Bath Road, Bristol. Doors open at 7 p.m. and tickets are £15 in advance and £18 on the door. Into Friday, 3rd of December, and the Led Zeppelin tribute act, Whole Lotta Lead, will be performing at the Fleece in St. Thomas Street, Bristol. Doors open at 8 p.m. and tickets are £10 in advance. This will also be the final tribute night ever at the Fleece. On to Song of the Week, and I present Paul McCartney. This is from the CD and DVD double live album, Good Evening New York City, which was released in 2009, and it's a track titled I Saw Her Standing There.
One, two, three. Well,
was at Paul McCartney with the track I Saw Her Standing There from the double live album Good Evening New York City. For more information, you can check out at www.paulmccartney.com. On to Saturday, 4th of December, Gonga will be performing with support from Rosicrucian at the Croft in Stoatscroft, Bristol. Doors open at 8 p.m. and tickets are £4 in advance. Finally, on Sunday, 5th of December, Choir Boys will be performing with support from Rebel Lust and also Empire of Fools at the Fleece in St Thomas Street, Bristol. Doors open at 8 p.m. and tickets are £11 in advance. That's all from me. Thanks for listening. Have a great week. Take care and goodbye.
Thank you very much to you, Jeff. Well, that's all from Dialect Radio this week. The studio guest was Steve Dale. Thank you very much to him from Bristol Volunteer Bureau. And the features are by Tony Gosling, Michaela Dennis and Anthea Page. Jeff Sparks presented the What's On Guide, and Trevor Carter read us some of his poetry. The studio engineer was Michael Noyes, and the producer was Anthea Page. It's goodbye from myself, John Peters Coleman, and we're going to play out this week with Julia from Nyaka.
Iwe Julia, lekasi ya mwana. Iwe Julia, lekasi ya mwana. Mwana salira, asalira iwe. Mwana salira, asalira iwe. Iwe Julia, lekasi ya mwana. Iwe Julia, lekasi ya mwana. Mwana salira, asalira iwe. Mwana salira, asalira iwe. Mwana ye, mwana ye, mwana ye. Iwe Julia, lekasi ya mwana. Iwe Julia, lekasi ya mwana. Mwana salira, asalira iwe. Mwana salira, asalira iwe. Mama ye, 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 mama ye. Legacy amwana, iwe Julia, legacy amwana, mwana salira, asalira iwe, mwana salira, asalira iwe. Busa.